Evidence of God in Cosmos and Conscience by Robert C. Newman, an abstract to this talk. The Bible claims God's invisible qualities, his power and divine nature, are clearly seen in what he has made. This is supported by a tour of nature. In the cosmos, this includes evidence of a beginning and of a designed universe. In human nature, we see a number of items that are not well explained by a mindless evolution. A high level of order, initiative, a level of intellect far beyond what is necessary. An unusual match between human rationality and the structured universe. The presence of moral, logical, and aesthetic standards. The existence of unnecessarily large amounts and varieties of pleasure. And the existence of futility. The Bible makes a rather strong claim regarding evidence for God. In Romans chapter 1, verse 20, the Apostle Paul says, "Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse." Well, we want to look at evidence of God then, in cosmos and in conscience. First of all, evidence of God in cosmos. Evidence from inanimate nature. The universe provides strong evidence for the existence of a God like the one pictured in the Bible. We examine two lines of evidence here. Evidence the universe had a beginning. Evidence the universe is designed. A beginning. Atheists must either claim that the universe has always existed or that it popped into existence without a cause. The history of cosmology in the past century argues strongly that the universe had a beginning. I see our discussion of that in several other of our PowerPoint talks. Cosmology in the 20th century started out, at least among atheists, with a static eternal universe model. The universe was not really doing anything on a large scale. The stars were moving around and such, but seemed to be basically in a general state that was about the same at all times. And many philosophers and scientists felt that the universe had always been. They realized that stars were shining, but didn't really know what caused that. And for all they knew, that might be something that could occur forever. As further evidence has cropped up, however, that picture has been undermined. First of all, there was the discovery by Vesto Slipher and Edwin Hubble of an expanding universe that made the universe no longer static, and the realization that stars are burning by some sort of nuclear fusion process, and therefore they are in fact using up fuel in producing this energy, and where does that fuel come from? How do you recycle that whole thing? Shortly after World War II, three British cosmologists proposed a steady-state universe model to retain an eternal universe even in the midst of the evidence that the universe is not static and that the stars are burning down. Their proposal basically was that matter was popping into existence. Perhaps they wouldn't say without a cause. They might say there is some creation law of some sort that brought matter into existence. But anyway, matter is popping into existence to provide new fuel for the stars to burn, and that the universe is continually expanding. But the discovery in the '60s of evidence that the universe was initially at a high density and high temperature tended to undermine the steady-state universe model, and the result is that cosmologists, by and large, moved to a Big Bang model of some sort that featured a high density and high temperature shortly after the Big Bang. The attempt then to retain an eternal universe was provided by making an oscillating Big Bang model, in which the Big Bang that was thought to have occurred some billions of years ago was in fact a big bounce from a collapsing universe before that, And the favored model, the oscillating model, was that the universe expanded and collapsed with a cycle of about 100 billion years. And so we retain an eternal universe, though it is now not static, and it is not in a steady state. However, the recent discovery of the acceleration of the universe's expansion, together with evidence that's been there all along but has become stronger, that there appears to be insufficient density in the matter energy of our universe to make it collapse, have tended to undermine the oscillating Big Bang model, together with evidence that the universe is probably not going to bounce if it collapses to a very high temperature, high density state, but presumably go into some kind of a black hole. So now, cosmologists are working with various varieties of the Big Bang, and among these are one in which the universe starts from scratch at the Big Bang, but again favored by scientists who do not want to have a beginning. You have what we might call Big Bang bubble models, in which our universe is just a bubble that has expanded from a somewhat different sort of eternal universe, which might for all that be static, perhaps like bubbles of carbonation coming out of a soft drink. You don't see anything there, and then the bubble appears and gets bigger and bigger until it comes up to the top and pops or something of that sort. Well, that's kind of where we are right now. There is, of course, no evidence, scientifically, for more than just the universe we see. And in fact, in your Big Bang bubble models, it would probably be unlikely that there would ever be any evidence for anything outside the bubble. But that is the direction that cosmology is going. The astronomer apologist Hugh Ross has proposed that a brief characterization of cosmology in the 20th century was that it represented a more and more frantic attempt to preserve an eternal universe in the face of mounting evidence that the universe had a beginning. Well, as far as we can tell from the inside, the universe has not always existed, but began at a finite time in the past. Claims that our universe is a bubble in a larger universe are really more of a leap in the dark than our claims that the universe was created by God. Claims that our universe just popped into existence without a cause are really desperate. Science itself and personal experience is based on the belief in causation, and yet there are scientists who are opting for that kind of solution. We move to the second matter here for evidence from inanimate universe, a designed universe. Atheists, of course, have no mind in the universe to produce design. The whole universe has evolved minds, and by that time you have virtually all of your structure, apparently. But they must therefore argue that all apparent design is not really design at all, but a clever and accidental fake. But the universe looks designed in ways that are far from trivial. Consider, for instance, the basic forces of the universe. There are currently four known basic forces that constitute the physics of our universe. Possibly the expansion that has recently been discovered may be a fifth force. We'll have to wait and see how that goes. These four known forces are the strong nuclear force, electromagnetism, the weak nuclear force, and gravity. These forces differ drastically in strength. If you put the strong nuclear force, which is the strongest of the four, at 1, then gravity has got a relative strength of about 1 over 10 to the 39 compared to gravity. So we're looking at 39 or 40 orders of magnitude between the strongest and the weakest of these forces. And yet they're very closely adjusted to allow life to exist. They're what we call fine-tuned. The strong force holds both neutrons and protons together to form the nucleus. If this force were only 5% weaker, the heavy version of hydrogen called deuterium would be unstable, and stars would not be able to burn. If this force were 5% stronger, the diproton would be stable, a very light form of hydrogen, of helium, excuse me, and stars would burn explosively. So basically the strong force is tuned to about plus or minus 10%. The weak force is a force that that can be characterized as holding the neutron together. It does some other things, but that will do. If it were a few percent weaker, neutron would be more unstable than it is, and the upshot would be that we would have no heavy elements. If the weak force were a few percent stronger, the neutron would be too stable, we might say, and we would have no hydrogen. So again, this force is fine-tuned to a few percent, plus or minus. The electromagnetic force is the force that holds electrons to atoms and atoms to one another, allowing neutral atoms and molecules and solids. This force depends on the balance of the positive and negative charges to both attract and repel. I realize positive charges repel each other, negative charges repel each other, but positive and negative charges attract each other. If this balance between positive and negative charges were off by 1 part in 10 to the 40th, that is, there were more electrons than protons by 1 part in 10 to the 40th or so, or the other way around, this force would swamp gravity, and there'd be no galaxies, stars, planets, or people. Oh, that force is very finely tuned as well. Gravity is the weakest of 4 forces, but it dominates all the other forces at astronomical distances. Gravity and the expansion of the universe are neatly balanced to produce a life-friendly universe. If the balance were off by 1 part in 10 to the 60th, let's say if gravity were weaker by 1 part in 10 to the 60th, the universe would have expanded too quickly early on, or, if it were off the other direction, would have collapsed too quickly early on, and we would never have formed planets, stars, or people. The life universe then is fine-tuned to allow life at the level of less than 1 part in 10 to the 100th. In an atheistic scheme, then, this would mean we'd need at least 10 to the 100 universes to expect this by chance. Well, if you wish to bet there is no God at these odds, you will have no one to blame but yourself if you are wrong. So, evidence of God in cosmos. We turn to the second topic, evidence of God in conscience. Evidence from animate nature and from humanity. We'll look at the high level of order in living things, initiative, we'll call it, in humans and higher animals, the level of intellect in humans, the structure of rationality in nature, human moral standards, and human pleasure, and human futility. Let's see. The high level of order in living things. The information content, says Carl Sagan in his article Life in the Encyclopedia Britannica, the information content of a simple cell is about 10 to the 12th power bits, equivalent to about 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. That's an enormous amount of order. Sagan's statement is just for the simple bacterium E. coli. Multicelled animals, especially human, are far more complicated than this. We have trillions of cells, and each cell is more complicated than the E. coli cell is. All the evidence we have suggests that the universe is incapable of producing this level of order by natural processes. We actually do some numbers and such in other of our PowerPoint talks. You might take a look at the PowerPoint talk, Computer Viruses, Artificial Life and the Origin of Life, or at Cosmos and Contact, Discerning Signs of Intelligence in the Universe. Initiative. Humans, and at least the higher animals, apparently have the ability to initiate actions that are not caused by any external necessity. One of the goals of artificial intelligence research, AI research, is to show that this can be produced by purely natural causes in a mindless universe. We should, however, not mistake research goals for research results. So far, they have not found any indication that this actually is so, that a sufficiently advanced computer will initiate actions that are not caused by any external necessity. Secondly, the level of intellect in humans appears to be far beyond what is needed in primitive conditions or in most situations today. Darwin's model of survival of the fittest, or competition for the resources, etc., basically proposed that the most efficient types of plants and animals would be the ones that would survive in their environment. He has run into a number of features that don't look like they're the most efficient, and has had to bring in sexual selection as another category to solve problems in this direction. Well, think about humans in the primitive conditions under which they were supposed to have evolved, and you can see that, yes, tool-making might be of some advantage. Running, climbing trees would certainly be of advantage, and that sort of thing. But the level of intellect in humans seems to be way beyond that. And in fact, way beyond what is needed in most situations today. And you would think then that if the energy of the human organism were put into stronger muscles or ability to run faster, rather than putting it into unneeded intellect, that those beings would be able to survive better than the others. This does not, in other words, fit what one would expect from evolution. Too much energy put into unneeded brain power takes away from what is needed to be a better competitor. This, in fact, suggests that mankind was designed for some purpose that requires considerably greater intellect than we now use. And that, of course, is the sort of picture that biblical Christianity gives of the purpose which God had in making man. Structure of rationality. Albert Einstein was puzzled by this, and is known for a quotation of his, "The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is its comprehensibility." That is, that the universe appears to be structured in such a way that our logical equipment can understand it. Now, why should the logic of the human mind happen to fit the logic of the universe? Well, suggestion is that human logic is perhaps well-designed to explain the universe. Can deal with all sorts of things we can never imagine it having had contact with during its supposed evolution. Mathematics, atomic structure, poetry. Yes. Einstein was amazed that man's mind, developed by mutation, should have categories to handle all this. But God might very well have designed the human mind to function well in the universe he made. Atheists have only mutation and natural selection to explain all this. Moral standards. If you've ever had an introductory philosophy class, you've probably run across the philosophical maxim that we cannot derive an ought from an is. That is, we can't convert statements about reality into moral statements. But the question then arises, where does this realm of human activity that involves making judgments by means of moral standards come from? Interestingly, the world's cultures contain strangely parallel moral standards. C.S. Lewis has pointed this out in a couple of his books. I think the one that deals the most with that would be The Abolition of Man, but he has a section in Mere Christianity called Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. World's cultures contain strangely parallel moral standards. This argues against independent development of morality and for a common source. Well, that's either going to push you back very, very early or suggest that we're looking at the activity of a designer in putting some kind of equipment, moral equipment we might call it, in the human being. Here's a cartoon from Calvin and Hobbes that deals with this particular question. Calvin is filling up a water balloon, And then he says, in order to determine if there's any universal moral law beyond human convention, I have devised the following test. I will throw this water balloon at Susie Durkins unless I receive some sign within the next 30 seconds that this is wrong. It is in the universe's power to stop me. I'll accept any remarkable physical happenstance as a sign that I shouldn't do this. Ready? Go. He begins to time it with his watch. Nothing happening. 5 seconds to go. Time's up. That proves it. There's no moral law. Wee ha ha. And he throws the balloon at Susie, and Susie comes charging after him. And now we find Calvin rather battered, lying on the ground. Why does the universe always give you the sign after you do it? Pleasure. Is all pleasure really biologically useful? If not, then how does one explain it evolutionarily? Lauren Wilkerson, in a chapter in John Warwick Montgomery's book, Christianity for the Tough-Minded, suggests that the strength and variety of human pleasures is far beyond what can be explained by biological utility. See Wilkinson's article, The Problem of Pleasure, in Montgomery, Christianity for the Tough-Minded. Lastly, futility. Humans have a sense of longing and a joy that does not seem to have any object in this world. Man appears to be a sort of a ruin. A ruin is not, of course, just junk, like unshaped stones. But a ruin is something that is not functioning as it appears to be designed to. So we can recognize a piece of a column from a Greek temple or something lying on the ground as a ruin. It's obviously been shaped, it had some intention, but it is not now functioning very well in that direction. This, what we might call frustrated design, is hard to explain by evolution, since there's no apparent reason for desires which transcend the present order. Well, that's our quick tour. Evidence of God in conscience. These items fit well with a God behind it all, especially the God of the Bible. High level of order in living things. Initiative in humans and higher animals. Level of intellect in humans. Structural rationality in nature. Human moral standards. Human pleasure. Human futility. The biblical claim, since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Romans 1, verse 20. That's the end of this talk. The rest is up to you.